Oyez, oyez, the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated.
Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 070599, Rutamco Operating Inc. versus Republic Drilling Company from Bexar County and the 4th Court of Appeals District. Docket number 070783, Irving W. Marks versus St. Luke's Episcopal Hospital from Harris County and the 1st Court of Appeals District. And 070787, Spectrum Healthcare Resources, Inc. and Michael Sims versus Janice McDaniel and Patrick McDaniel from Bexar County and the 4th Court of Appeals District. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in each argument and expects to complete all well before noon, and we will take a brief between the arguments. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is now ready to hear argument in 070599, Rutamco Operating Inc. versus Republic Drilling.
May it please the court, Mr. Drought will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, I'm assisted in this case with my partner of 30 years, Cal Bobbitt. This is a special appearance case. Our client, Rutamco, sued Republic in Bexar County. Republic then filed a special appearance, which the trial court denied. The Court of Appeals reversed, holding that the Michiana's purposeful availment standard was not met by when there was only one sole contact that took place in Texas. What I'd like to discuss with you today are what are the operative facts of a fraudulent conveyance cause of action, what were Republic's contacts with Texas, and how were those contacts substantially connected to Republic's cause of action under the Fraudulent Transfer Act? Or stated another way, how does the record in this case satisfy the substantial connection to operative facts that y'all established in Mokumak? And finally, time permitting, I want to discuss with you how Republic's Republic purposely availed itself of the protections and benefits of the laws of the state of Texas. Now, the background in this case is long. Rutamco filed suit against Paradigm in 1999 in San Antonio, alleging causes of action for breach of contract and fraud regarding royalties that were due our client, Rutamco. And while the suit was pending, Paradigm conveyed its oil and gas interest in Fayette County and Webb County to Republic, which is an affiliated company.
And how is it affiliated? Does the record reflect that?
The record reflects it. We pled it. They've never denied it.
Does the record reflect how it's affiliated?
I'm not certain that it does, but it's a Republic is a parent company of Paradigm. What Republic does not contest in this case is that this case involves a Texas company, Rutamco, that sued a Texas company, Paradigm, in a Texas district court under the Uniform Transfer Act, involving oil and gas leases that are in the state of Texas, and that while this suit was pending, these oil and gas interests were transferred from Paradigm to Republic.
What exactly were the interests?
The interests were 74 oil and gas leases in Fayette County and one great big the Briscoe lease is a 40,000-acre lease.
No, I mean, what was the interest in the leases?
There was a working interest. But it wasn't a passive working interest. I mean, a working interest is more than just passive because you've got responsibilities, but it was a working interest. But they were not the operator. It was a working interest in the leases.
But they would have responsibility to pay expenses as well as receive revenues?
Yes, sir. That's correct. So the record also reflects that after this transfer took place, Paradigm became insolvent. Now, the record also shows that this transfer was made without the payment of the reasonable equivalent value, and...
But under Michiana, do we care whether it was fraudulent or not?
Yes, sir.
That's for the jury, right?
Well,
Should the trial judge be deciding whether it's fraudulent or not? If it's fraudulent, it stays in Texas. If it's not fraudulent, it goes. Isn't that kind of what the jury's supposed to do?
No, Your Honor, I think that in this case, when we're talking about substantial contacts with the operative facts, we have joint tortfeasors. Both Paradigm and Republic are joint tortfeasors, and I think that needs to be taken into consideration, and that was not the case in Michiana or Mokemak.
Well, that's not what the plaintiff said in Michiana.
Yeah, well...
And if we defer to the trial court in Michiana, it comes out the other way, doesn't it?
Well, the trial
misrepresented something to somebody in Texas?
The trial court in this case ruled in our favor, and all of the facts that implied facts are in our favor. And I think that in Michiana, you had one telephone contact made with an out-of-state defendant. I think I'm going to be able to show you a lot more than that in this case. So, I mean, the...
you make sales of working interests on Texas leases if it's to somebody in California. And if it's fraudulent, you can sue them in Texas. If it's not fraudulent, you can't.
If it's not fraudulent,
you can't sue them anyway.
Right.
So aren't you arguing we should decide the case on the jurisdictional inquiry?
Well, I think that if Republic participated in a fraudulent transaction in a bilateral tort like the Fraudulent Conveyance Act, it is committed an act here that the operative facts are connected to the conduct of the defendant, and I think that you should reverse on that opinion.
How do we know though that this transaction was fraudulent?
Because we've alleged it. We had facts in our record that supported it. For instance, that there was no consideration paid, or very little consideration paid, that it rendered Paradigm insolvent. I think they haven't denied that, and also the trial court ruled in our favor, and so all implied facts are considered to our benefit.
But you would agree that you have to do more than just allege a transfer that under the UFTA statute. It's more than just an allegation. There's got to be some proof of fraud, and then you have to establish it again before the jury, or how does that work?
Well, yeah, we have to establish it again before the jury, but we pled it.
Right.
And then it became Republic's responsibility to negate it, and they didn't. McCallum testified that Paradigm became insolvent. There was testimony that no consideration was paid or very little consideration was paid. These are all elements of a fraudulent conveyance act, and we pled that, and they didn't negate it. I would have to prove it again.
Do you think we can distinguish Michiana and Mokemak on the fact that the property itself is located here? Those cases, we were concerned with fortuitous sort of contacts with the state, but in this case, we've got leases that are actually located here. And
you can distinguish it on that point, but you can also distinguish it on the point that Republic participated in a fraud, and when you have a the Fraudulent Conveyance Act, you need to understand that it takes two people to do that. Fraudulent conveyance is a tort. The tortfeasors are the transferor, Paradigm, and the transferee, Republic. And the injury occurs, or the tort occurs, where the injury results. And the injury resulted when the assignments were filed in the state of Texas by Republic. So I think you can distinguish it on both of those points. But the petition in our case specifically alleged, and this was to answer some of your questions, we specifically alleged that Paradigm and Republic actively participated in a fraudulent transfer of Texas assets while the suit was pending against Paradigm and with knowledge of Ratomco's claims, and that it was made, this is what our petition said, to hinder, delay, and defraud Ratomco, that reasonably equivalent value was not paid, and that Paradigm became insolvent. And the one thing that occurred in California is they signed the assignment of the oil and gas interests there. And it was because of that single fact that the Court of Appeals felt that that the due process clause would be offended if Republic was called to defend itself here in Texas. Now, I want to talk about the substantial connection to the operative facts. And in addressing the operative facts, Republic's contacts, and the connection to Ratomco's cause of action under the UFTA, first of all, I mentioned that it is a tort, and the tortfeasors are both the parties. But also under the UFTA, this section 24.007, it basically provides that the tort is accomplished when the assignment is completed by filing it in the county clerk's office. Now, the Republic's contacts with Texas are not just substantially connected to the operative facts of this litigation. They are the operative facts of this litigation, because it's important to recognize in a fraudulent transfer case that doesn't fit in neatly to the substantial connection that you have in a fraud or a misrepresentation case. But this is not because there isn't a substantial connection between the contacts and the operative facts of the case. There most definitely is. Unlike a fraud case or a misrepresentation case, like you had in Mokimac, in a fraudulent conveyance case, the focus is not on the defendant's contacts or actions with the plaintiff, but instead it's on the defendant's relationship to the debtor, the debtor's property, and the transfer of the property. And here, Republic's contacts with Paradigm and Paradigm's property and the document that transferred Paradigm's property are the operative facts of this case.
And the Paradigm was an Arizona corporation.
No, it's a Texas corporation.
If it were an Arizona corporation, and these leases were in Texas and transferred, what would your position be?
If we had jurisdiction over Paradigm otherwise?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that we would still have a cause of action because the fraud occurred here.
Well, if the focus is on the debtor's in Arizona.
Well, the focus is on the debtor, the property to be conveyed. You're talking about Texas property?
These exact same facts, but the debtor's in Arizona.
Right. I think that the same, if we otherwise have jurisdiction over the debtor, then the same rule would apply. We would have jurisdiction because the fraud occurred here in Texas. The
So are you arguing for a special rule of personal jurisdiction when Uniform Fraudulent Conveyance Act or Transfer Act is at issue?
Well, I don't think it's a special rule, but I think that when you have...
Because normally we respect separate corporate entities.
Right. Well, I'm not advocating that a special rule be adopted, but I think that under specific jurisdiction, when you have a Fraudulent Conveyance Act, because you've got two tortfeasors that are committing a tort in Texas involving Texas property, that we have satisfied the Due Process Clause. So what we have here is an out-of-state defendant, Republic, that's making a conscious decision to participate in a scheme to place Texas property into the hands of its Texas affiliate, or out of the hands of its Texas affiliate, and outside the reach of our Texas creditor. And this transaction involving a Texas debtor, Texas creditor, Texas property, and the pending Texas suit would never have happened unless Republic was involved in this case. And I see my time is up, so I'll sit down and address the rest of it in a minute. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Alexander will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, I'd like to focus on two points. First, the question by Justice Brister concerning do we focus on fraudulent transfer at the special appearance stage, and then the point question raised by Justice O'Neill about the property being located in Texas and how do we grapple with that. Turning first to the fraudulent transfer, no. At the special appearance stage, we do not get into that question. The two things that we focus on, and this is really what was wrestled with in Michiana, are the actions by the defendant, the reasonable expectations of the defendant, not the allegations against the defendant. We don't do that at the special appearance stage. And in this case, let's focus first on the actions and then the reasonable expectations. The actions here alleged were that a California corporation was the fraudulent transferee of property, and that property was non-operating mineral interest. Okay, it was passive, non-operating mineral interest. That was the action, and everything occurred in California. I mean, we're talking about Paradigm being
the corporation's related.
They're related. The record is not clear exactly how. They are affiliated. But the other thing I think that is significant when we're talking about the actions of the parties, because they're talking about joint tortfeasors, Paradigm, although a Texas corporation, I think the record also reflects the principal office is in California, and all the principals are in California. So this is a case where when they talk about where did the fraud occur, the alleged fraud all occurred in California. I mean, that's where the alleged scheme was supposedly hatched. If there was bad faith on the part of the transferee, that was all done in California. The one connection here is that the property is in Texas.
I'm jumping ahead a little bit.
Sure.
Let's assume that they conclusively proved that there was a fraudulent transfer, that there was this relationship, and Republic received these intending to make Paradigm insolvent and make sure the principals were able to retain their money. Let's assume that that was proved. Wouldn't Texas have an interest in having that case tried here? Because you defraud a plaintiff in Texas of assets that were owed to it through a proper, in this case, default judgment.
Well, let's get right
assuming
to that.
Assuming a whole lot, I know.
Yeah, no, it's assuming a lot, but I think it does jump ahead to the question of the property, because I think that frankly, this case implicates a lot of very difficult issues with respect to minimum contacts. And let me nuance your question, if I can, with different types of property. I think that if we were talking about, let's take one of these large new condominiums that we have in Austin. Let's say that the property that was being fraudulently transferred, was such a huge apartment complex. I think that you would say that in that case, yes, Texas would have an interest in having that litigated in Texas, and I'll explain a little bit why in a second.
And
however,
are you also assuming that the interest is passive?
I'm assuming that the interest is...
The condos is passive.
Well, no. Actually, in the condo case, I'm not assuming passive, and that's why I want to give you the scale. I'm assuming active. I'm assuming that you have a Canadian corporation comes in and acquires the condo, and it's not passive. In that case, I think everyone would conclude that Texas would have the interest in litigating. But now let's take the case of, you know, an investor in Montana has got an investment portfolio. Part of that is it invests in one of these real estate investment trusts, so they get a passive interest in this condo down in Texas. In that case, I say no. That Texas, in that instance, would not have an interest. Now, the problem, I guess, with the question is that it does ask us to assume a lot, because it asks us to assume ourselves outside of Michiana. I mean, the problem is that when you go back to Michiana, we simply don't get to that question at this stage. And I think it's important to understand that as well. We're at the stage in the case where, from the standpoint of the courts, we are not deciding whether the conduct was bad, you know, whether the plaintiff has a legitimate claim, whether the plaintiff has a legitimate claim, whether the defendant was wrongful or rightful. We just don't do that at that stage, and that's what makes these cases so difficult, is that you draw these lines where, for instance, in Michiana, the dissenting justices are appalled by the fact that you've got a plaintiff with a cause of action that's it seems everybody seemed to admit that there was fraud, and yet you don't get there in terms of Texas jurisdiction, because again, at the special appearance stage, we don't get that far. Now let me get back to the property interest. Why should it make a difference? Why do we care if, you know, it's an active or passive interest? And I think,
well, a fraudulent transfer is a little bit different than your typical sort of fraud. I mean, you transferred an interest in the property that's a working interest. The Republic is responsible for maintaining the leases, paying money on the leases. It assumed the obligation. So it's, in a sense, it's contractual in nature. It's the passage of contract rights over. And we said in Mokimac that there would be a breach of contract claim in Texas. So it seems to me that this falls more on that line of the spectrum. It wasn't that they made a random telephone call that the sale was based on. You've got, they could be sued here for anything connected with the lease.
They could, but let's get down and kind of, I think we're really to the nub of the issue of where we draw the line. And let's spend some time talking about that. Here's the problem with that. Yes, it's different than, for instance, owning stock. I mean, I think with stock, you just risk your investment. When you're talking about a non-operating interest, you are on the line for expenses as well. Okay? So far, so good. But nonetheless, it still is a passive interest. We're not dealing with state regulators every day. What we have is a situation, and let me bring this back into principles we can talk about under minimum contacts. What you have is a situation in which, and this is, I think this is a point to remember, you can structure your dealings to avoid jurisdiction. I mean, everybody agrees that's what was said in Worldwide Volkswagen. That's what was echoed in Michiana.
But there's a little twist on it here, yeah, when you're talking about a fraudulent transfer. Can you intentionally do that to
the state
of Texas?
This is why I want to get back to this business of the fact that you can be liable on a contract. Yes, you can be called into a Texas court if, for instance, you fail to make, if you default on your expenses. Okay? But what you can do in that situation is that you can structure your conduct so that does not occur. In other words, you say, I am not going to invest in an oil well in South Texas unless I have sufficient money in the bank that I will never find myself in a South Texas court defending a breach of contract action. That's something over which you have control. What you don't have, the concern here with fraudulent conveyance or fraudulent transfer is,
sorry,
it's so easy to
elect. Can you repeat that? I missed that.
Okay. What you have said is that that when you are in a position where you owe expenses, there are situations where if you breach your contract, you can be hauled into a Texas court. Okay? Now, mind you, that doesn't have anything to do with our lawsuit here. But my point is this. You can structure your conduct so that that does not occur. In other words, if I'm an investor in Montana and I'm looking at investing in Texas, and I never in my life want to find myself in a South Texas court for either breach of contract or fraud, what I can do is to say I'm going to make sure I've got sufficient money in the bank that that will never happen, that I will never be liable for breach of contract.
But that doesn't mean you can't be sued here.
Well, it does if you don't breach your contract. What would you be sued for?
I just don't understand the concept of putting money here to cover it.
Okay, what I'm saying is that, and again, I think that we're getting down to nub issues, you're not going to be sued here if you do not default. Okay, in other words, if you structure your conduct so that you never default on your obligations, why would you be sued? And the problem is, again, in structuring your conduct, what you don't want to... What's that?
If there's a title dispute.
Well, the title dispute, then you're really, at that point...
Somebody reappears in South Texas saying 100 years ago, this was really all belonged to my family.
Okay, then the person in the court for that is the operator. I mean, that's where I think you have to draw the line.
What about royalty interest? You want to enforce your royalty? The royalty interest that you have, you say you have a non-participating interest as
well.
That's
correct.
So you would have to enforce that here, wouldn't you?
Well, enforce it if that ever became a problem. And again, I'm not trying to be cute with the court on this. What you have is, this is such an important case because we have thousands of people who make these kind of investments. It's kind of like, and let me back up and give
a close example.
But
not that many who make fraudulent transfers. And what it sounds to me like what you're saying is if you have a fraudulent transfer case, it sort of your argument sort of immunizes anybody from out of state.
Oh, no, absolutely not. I mean, I think that, and let's make this clear, and let's clear this out of the way, too. No one is trying to immunize anybody. One thing that is important to understand, we're just asking where is this to be adjudicated. California has a Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act. It's the California Civil Code, Section 3439. It is identical to Texas. Identical. We don't have choice of law problems in this case. If the plaintiff here goes and sues in California, they have jurisdiction over this California corporation. They have a cause of action under a Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act that is identical to Texas. So the question is, in cases like this, do we require the plaintiff to go out of state, or do we force the defendant to come to Texas? That's the tough question. And the problem is, I mean, just to give you another example, let's say that you buy shares in a Texas corporation, and it's alleged that you fraudulently transferred them. Are you going to force the defendant in Montana, who's completely innocent, to come down to Texas to defend against that?
Are there any California cases that present the same type of issue that you've seen?
No. Are you talking about on the
Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act, an out-of-state defendant applying that statute in California? It's like we're trying to do here in Texas. Are you familiar with any cases out of California like that?
Yeah, I mean, there are, and we've looked at some of them. There's none that, frankly, give us much guidance on this because none of them are involving non-operating mineral interests that we've seen. So there's none that help us much. But getting back to my point, again, we're not talking about immunizing anybody. We're not talking about denying anybody a remedy. The only question is which court do we have to adjudicate it?
One of the things we've always been concerned with in these analyses is somebody being hailed into court here unexpectedly. They've never had enough contacts here to expect to be hailed into court.
Correct.
But they can expect clearly to be hailed into court on a number of causes of action just based on their ownership interest and their ongoing obligation on these leases. And so are we parsing it just a little too thin?
I don't think so. And that's what, I mean, and let's talk about that. I don't think we're parsing it too thin because, again, when I make this investment, I'm a Montana investor investing in Texas, I am fully prepared to be hauled into court if it's alleged that I've breached my obligations.
I'm not prepared to be hauled into court because some yahoo accuses me of fraudulent transfer. Okay? In other words, I will voluntarily assume the risk that I'll default and somebody will pull me in. I am not going to voluntarily assume that somebody somewhere, because, I mean, again, if you're a plaintiff, there's three things that you want in a lawsuit. You want liability, damages, and collectability. And in a case in which the operator is no longer the deep pocket, what do people start doing? They start digging around for other people. So it's a very real concern. And the reason I don't think it's parsing it too thin is, again, you're talking over here about contract. But under what circumstances can you get hauled in on a fraud case? And let's talk about reasonable expectations, because I think this is important. And let me give this an overlay that I think will help. If you look at the Guardian Royal case, I think that the Guardian Royal case gives us a lot of help with the whole idea of the state interest. When can we bring in the state regulations to kind of inform or tip the balance with respect to the minimum contact inquiry? And let me give you a classic contrast that I think helps illuminate this. McGee. McGee was a case in which there was an out-of-state insurance company that was doing business in California, that is selling policies to California residents, but never stepped foot in the state. And in that case, there's a statute that says, which subjected foreign corporations to suit in California on insurance contracts with residents. Okay, now talking about reasonable expectations, if you were a foreign insurance company contemplating doing business in California, do you have a reasonable expectation of being brought into the state? If somebody says you wrongfully sued on a, you know, wrongfully did not pay a claim, the answer is absolutely yes, because here you have a statute that you can look at and says, well, guess what happens if I engage in business in California? Let's contrast that with our case. In our case, we have a statute that says this. This is the Texas Business Corporation Act. A foreign corporation, my client, shall not be considered to be transacting business in the state by reason of acquiring in transaction outside of Texas, which happened here, non-operating mineral interests, which are the interests involved in this case. So if I'm, you know, if I'm in Montana and I go see a lawyer and I say, I never in my life want to find myself in a suit in South Texas based on this investment, particularly for fraud, if the question of good faith is being brought into question, advise me. Am I going to be drawn in on some spurious claim for fraudulent transfer? I think that the lawyer looking at this would say, no, because the state of Texas has decided that that is such a minimal contact. It's a passive situation as contrasted with, and these are the examples provided in Guardian Royal. If you're engaged in insurance, if you're actively marketing your insurance policies into Texas, you're going to be nailed. If you are actively, and this is another example, securities. If you're actively marketing securities in the state of Texas, then you are going to be subject to suit here and a suit on that. If you are actively producing hazardous toxic wastes and they end up in a Texas stream, you're going to be hauled into court here. Reasonable expectations. In each of those cases, there is a reasonable expectation on the part of the defendant, and again, erasing the question of whether there is liability, that if a suit is brought, I am going to be brought into Texas for that.
What do you do in our case?
If Peridot files bankruptcy, the trustee can bring Republic in to collect on these leases, can it? I mean, the idea that you'd be shocked to be brought into Texas.
Well, brought into Texas on what? This is the question of risk.
But couldn't the trustee in bankruptcy bring in Republic from California on a fraudulent transfer theory? I mean, if I'm the lawyer advising.
Okay. That's where I draw the line. No. I mean, I think, first off, back up and let's look at what.
I'm advising my client in Montana.
Okay.
And can I, in good faith, tell them that the bankruptcy trustee cannot bring you in on fraudulent transfer into a Texas bankruptcy court?
I don't know the answer to that question. That's not our case. I don't know the answer. I think not, but I don't know. But in our case, I'm talking about a private litigant. I mean, I'm not talking about a bankruptcy trustee. I mean, once you're bringing in, you know, a trustee.
We're talking about reasonable expectations about being hailed into a Texas court.
For what? I have a reasonable expectation of being hailed. If I default, and this is why it's so important, substantial connection, Moki Mac. If I default on my contract to make payments, I have a reasonable expectation of being brought into court for that, okay? Because there is a substantial connection between the allegation and what I'm being brought into court for. But to say that because over here I can be brought into court for a breach of contract, that perforce means that I have forever waived the notion that I can be brought in for something over here, that's disturbing.
If Republic had signed the contract in Texas, would your argument be different?
Somewhat, yes. And I think because, I mean, we're focused on two things. I mean, one is the actions. The other is the reasonable expectations. Here, all of the actions were in California. So if one of those actions happened to have been of Texas, that would weigh closer towards minimum contact. So,
but
yes, it would.
Isn't where the contract signed a bit fortuitous, completely in the party's control?
And is there something wrong with that? I mean, I'm back to potential defendants may structure their primary conduct with some minimum assurance as to where that conduct will and will not render them liable to suit worldwide Volkswagen.
But is land different? We're not talking about a piece of personal property. We're talking about a piece of Texas. It can never be taken out of Texas. And the allegation is a party that owns direct interest in this dirt was involved in fraud in obtaining ownership of the dirt.
Well,
does that make it different from couch, where there's an argument about fraud and ownership of a couch or piece of personality?
Yes, and yet it's the type of interest involved. In other words, and again, I really would tell the court to wrestle with Guardian Royal when we're talking about governmental regulation. If the piece of dirt that we're talking about, again, is the condominium down here, so that and it's owned in fee, so that every day I'm dealing with regulators on ADA issues.
You're not dealing with any regulators. You just are part owner in the property, and somebody else manages it.
I think a total passive non-operating interest, so that I am not dealing with state regulators on a daily basis, then it is more like stock. It would be almost like, or like owning that, you know, being an investor in a real estate investment trust. I mean, do we want in Texas to say that if you are merely investing in a venture, an incorporeal interest where you get money but you have to write checks, if that's really all it is, that anytime, anywhere, and that's the problem with this, somebody alleges fraudulent transfer, you're in court in Texas, that's a huge concern. That is not far away of saying if you merely own stock in a Texas corporation, you own a piece of that corporation in Texas. But are we going to say that if you just own some shares of stock, if somebody, you know, in Montana invests in that Texas corporation, they have to come to Texas for that? I think not.
Justice Green.
I apologize, Your Honor, Chief. Mr. Alexander, you haven't talked about the implied findings in the trial court's order. Could you address whether that has any impact, in your opinion, on whether or not the court actually found that there was some fraudulent transfer in this case?
I think that we had was a denial of a special appearance. I don't think that, again, under Michiana, there's no applied finding of anything. I mean, you know, back to Michiana, we had it, and I think it was repeated seven times in the dissenting opinion. We had someone who was admitting that they were liable for fraud. We don't have this here. I have a client who is saying, absolutely not, I'm not liable for fraudulent transfer. And under Michiana, that's not an inquiry we get into. So, again, I mean, we have to, and that's what, again, that's what makes these cases difficult, because depending on where you draw the line, there are going to be either innocent plaintiffs who have to go out of state. But for every innocent plaintiff that has to go out of state, how many innocent defendants are there going to be dragged into Texas on contacts that I say, under all of these factors, including the Guardian Royal governmental interest, which merely, and once again under that, that does not even supply the minimum contact. It can only tip the scale. We don't have minimum contacts here.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
One statement that Mr. Alexander made that there's no proof in the record of, he said that something to the effect that Paradigm is a California corporation or its principal offices in California. There's absolutely nothing in the record to that effect. Paradigm is a Texas corporation, and its all of its conduct was occurred here in Texas.
He said it was operated out of there.
Pardon me?
Said it was operated out of there. The principals were.
I thought he said that its principal office was in California.
Just the principals, I think.
That's not correct. Now, regarding purposeful availment, the record in this case shows that Republic acquired a substantial interest in a number of oil and gas leases and oil wells. And since then, Republic has participated in the drilling of numerous oil and gas wells. In that connection, it has acquired ownership and personal property in connection with these wells. And it assumed the liabilities of Paradigm regarding Paradigm's operation of these wells.
What has it done so far that a purely passive investor would not have done?
Well, it's paid, so far, it's paid $225,000 in operating expenses to...
Wouldn't a passive investor have to do that?
Well, I think so, but it's also received $1.2 million. But
investor would do that.
Well, that's true, too. But it's assumed liabilities.
Passive investor would do that.
Well, I'm not so sure about that one, because if you assume liabilities, you're liable to be sued here, and so I don't see, I mean, this is not a passive investment. This is, in fact, in this case, it wasn't an investment at all, because Republic got this interest without paying anything for it. But I don't think this is a passive investment. When you own working interest in an oil well in Texas, you own personal property, you own the land.
Have you sued Republic anywhere else?
When this case was dismissed, we sued in California, because we didn't want to lose our statute of limitations claim, but we made it subject to being, you know, if this court reversed, that we would dismiss California and pursue here. But when Republic took these leases, it became bound to the Texas operating agreements, gas purchase agreements, gas transportation agreements, all of the agreements that are related to working interest. It became bound to do that. If the operator didn't pay, Republic would sue here in Texas for payment of its royalties. And it acquired all of the rights under an oil and gas lease, all of the warranties, covenants, and things of that nature. It acquired all of those rights and has the rights to sue here in Texas. It's taking advantage of Texas laws.
All of that would have happened after the agreement, after the deal was done.
That's true.
So all the deal did was make those potential liabilities and those potential actions viable against them. And as I understand opposing counsel's position, he's not fussing about that. He's just saying that prior to the deal being done, which is what you're suing on, he can't be sued on those actions because they took place in California. And am I missing your position vis-a-vis his?
Well, what I'm saying is that under the purposeful availment standard, when you're considering specific jurisdiction, you can look to other conduct or additional conduct that may indicate an intent of the corporation to be bound or to take advantage of Texas laws. And so we're not alleging general jurisdiction here, but we do believe that Republic's contacts after the fact of actually signing the assignment are relevant to specific performance and particularly to the purposeful availment standard. And like I said before, it has paid $225,000 in operating expenses. It has received $1.2 million. And Republic deliberately engaged in this entire factual scenario to defraud our client by transferring this property or getting this property from its affiliate. And our client, Steve Goes, who owns Retomco, calls me up from time to time, and he says, Jim, this case is like bear meat. The more you chew it, the tougher it gets. And so it is with this special appearance law. We've had 15 cases or so where the Texas resident has lost every one of them. And going back to the CMMC case back in 1996, you know, this court said that we have so frequently and so recently reiterated the constitutional standards determining personal jurisdiction that we need not restate them again. And then it stated what the law is. But I think what's happened here is that the San Antonio court has taken a look at Michiana and Mokimak, and it is interpreting it in a way much more restrictive than what this court intended. And in by doing so, it is frustrating the rights of Texas residents to protect themselves. And so we respectfully request that the court reverse. Thank you.
If there are no further questions, the clause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.